And good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We are building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm again joined by our co-host Mona Hill, and our guest today are Mike Medby and Dr. Garson Hunter. And actually, I guess I could include myself and Mona, because we've all had experiences with the G20 protest rallies in Toronto. And we're going to talk about it. Mona's and my experiences were not quite the same as Garson's and Mike's, and I think you're going to learn something. So, Mona, take it away.
Oh, hi, everybody. Welcome back. Yeah, we had an exciting time. Jim and I went to the Amnesty International AGM, as I had mentioned before we left on the show last time we were here, which was deliberately planned to take place during the same time frame as the G8 and G20 meetings in Toronto. We wanted to, as Amnesty, we wanted to be a part of that because we are a human rights organization, and we defend human rights, and we felt that it was very important that we be included in this. So I guess probably what we'll start with is the fact that during the course of the events that in Toronto, there was a number of actual protests. There were a number of rallies. The first one that I know of that I had been in touch with the coordinator of this was for the Thursday, the June 24th, and that was regarding Indigenous rights. And this had been planned for many, many months beforehand, and it was by a group called themselves Red Power United. And the group's history comes out of AIM, the American Indian Movement. And they had planned to have many different rallies across the country on the 24th to protest the lack of our government's attention to First Nation and any other sorts of Indigenous human rights and all of the violations that have been taking place. And so that had been planned for the 24th. Unfortunately, we couldn't be there for that one. I don't imagine any of you saw any media coverage of that at all. That was at Queen's Park, and I believe that they also had a march. So when we showed up on the 25th, our meeting started, I think, on the Friday, wasn't it, Jim, on the 25th. And by Saturday, we decided that we were going to be a part of the protest, and we would take place in the protest march. And it started at Queen's Park, which is, for those of you who don't know Toronto, is sort of in right downtown Toronto.
It's where the legislature is.
Yeah, similar to where the legislative buildings are. It would be similar to going to, I would say, maybe Wascana Park in Regina, only it's a lot bigger. The legislative buildings are there. And Queen's Park had originally been designated by, was it by the City of Toronto? Correct me if I'm wrong, you two. It was designated as a safe place for protests, a safe place for rallies.
Yeah, what they call free speech.
A place for free speech, right? Yeah. Where there would be no harassment.
You're right.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a designated demonstration area, free speech.
So. Right. Okay, so this is where it all started, was at Queen's Park. For most people, this is where it all started. And I'll introduce Mike Medby now and let you tell us a little bit about what was the reason that you decided you wanted to be in Toronto? What's your background, and why was it a concern for you to be at this G20?
Okay, well, first, my background isn't anything special. I'm just a working stiff here. I'm a drafter with an engineering company. And in January, when there were those anti-prorogue protests, that's when I first got into this social activism. So some colleagues and I have been trying to get as active as we can in these movements for progressive politics and activism, because let's face it, going out and voting isn't getting us any results anymore. So we have to start doing something more. So one of the initiatives that we took was to go to Toronto to be there in solidarity with everyone else, standing up for what they believe is right, and shouting at our leaders against what we think is wrong with what they're planning for the world.
Okay, thanks. And Garson, you've been on the show before. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I would like to know what your perspective was on why you decided to go to the G20. What was going on before that?
Yeah, I was. I'm on a 5-month sabbatical from the university. I had two specific destinations. One was with the Olympic Resistance Network in Vancouver, where I was with the Black Bloc. And then again in Toronto, this time I was a journalist with the G20 Alternative Media Center, again to cover the Black Bloc. On this particular day, the 26th, my specific purpose was to photograph and document the police behavior and interaction.
So were you concerned? It sounds like before you left, you were very concerned that there was going to be specific behaviors that needed to be documented amongst coming from the police.
Yeah. I saw that in Vancouver many times because although there's legal observers, they often focus on the actions of the demonstrators because they're kind of exciting. They don't so much focus on the actions of the police, and that's what I wanted to focus on. I saw many incidences of police misconduct in Vancouver. This time I had set out to specifically look at the police behavior in Toronto. I had a very specific goal in mind.
Okay.
Based upon my experiences with the Olympic Resistance Network in Vancouver.
Okay. Did you participate in the march, or were you just there more or less to photograph the march itself?
I was there. I watched the march go by. I took some photographs, and I was watching for the block to come, because that's when I was going to start right in with the march. So I was there as the block turned on the second street heading towards the fence, right at the front there with them as they turned down the street to test the police response. So that was right from the start with the block.
So two things I'd like to make clear, and just to help our listeners understand the perspective, you mentioned a number of times a group called the Black Bloc.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the media had covered a little bit of this, and that, you know, it's been out there publicly that this was a group of people who were the ones to be watched and the ones to be rallied together and arrested because they had plans that were, that the police believed were detrimental to Canada or something like that,
right,
or to the G20.
Right.
Can you give us a little bit of a picture of what the Black Bloc is about?
The Bloc isn't really a group. The Bloc is a tactic. It emerged from Europe. I have some of it in my online story that I wrote for Dominion News from the experiences in Toronto, so I have more of a detailed history in there, but very quickly. It emerged from Europe. It was a way, it's a tactic, it's a way for different people to come together and move beyond the official sort of sanctioned protests to also then move into what can be thought of as disruptive actions. So the Bloc isn't so much a group of people. Like, there's not an organization called the Bloc. The Bloc is a group of people who will come together for a period of time, a loose collective of people, and then disband again after an event. So it's a tactic. It's not an organization.
Okay. And this is a tactic to create opportunity to maybe have a point of view put out there publicly that is not, that they feel it, you can't get out just by having a protest march?
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Really quickly then, they're a type of a disruptive movement. And disruptive movements are social change movements that occur in extraordinary moments when ordinary people rise up in anger and defy the rules that regulate their daily lives and disrupt the workings of the institutions in which they live. That they are by their nature a loose collective of people that break the rules and question the legitimacy of power. Disruptive movements are to be differentiated from what we would see as the more common community mobilization movements. These would be more familiar to people as NGOs, CBOs, like Amnesty International.
Like Amnesty.
Amnesty, yeah. Council of Canadians, the labor movement, Greenpeace, etc. These types of organizations, they will most often use nonviolent protests to make noise or demonstrate on the streets whereby they attempt to communicate their grievances using banners, slogans, rallies, street theater, to build a movement and to recruit allies. That's the essential point. For the NGOs, the community mobilization movements, it's to gain powerful allies. These powerful allies come on side with their cause and try and effect some sort of change. We saw this with Gandhi's movement. We saw this with Martin Luther King, etc. For example, King got the support of the white liberal middle class United States when they challenged segregation laws. He lost support from the white middle class liberals once his movement moved away from just civil rights into poverty issues. So when we talk about the white liberals were willing to support who could sit at the lunch counter, but once the question moved to who can pay for it, Martin Luther King lost his white middle class allies. So the idea of community mobilization is to effect change through gathering powerful allies who will then help their cause. When that doesn't happen, then the tactic has to really be looked at for its effectiveness. How effective is it if, in fact, there are no powerful allies who will come on side to help to address some of the grievances? So what will happen here is that disruptive movements will also do the same things as community mobilization movements, but there is a time. The difference is that disruptive movements may escalate tactics to include vandalism and or violence. Amongst all the endless debates about what are good protest movements or good bad protest movements, the meaning and strategy, I think, gets lost. Nonviolence can be used in strategic ways just as disruption through property damage and violence against state security can be strategic. The question of whether a strategy is effective can be measured against any other strategy or tactic that's used. So that's a real quick rundown on the block. They, again, aren't a group. They're a tactic that's okay. used. It's to move beyond the more normal community mobilization movements that we saw in Toronto, that the official sanction march. What will happen is that over time, we don't see anything on the concerns of people around the environment about improvements for the poor, indigenous rights, et cetera, then disruptive movements will escalate into vandalism or violence as well. So that's how we can sort of understand what they're doing.
Okay, thanks for that perspective.
Yep.
Okay, I think that helps us out a little bit. Let's get back to you, Mike.
Okay.
When you went to Toronto, you had intended on being there to be a part of this protest because of your own personal reasons.
Mm-hmm.
How far did you get into this? What was your experience? If you could just give us a little bit of a rundown of what your experience was.
Okay. Well, a little while before the G20 was scheduled to happen, I decided I was going to start producing a podcast to try to get this Saskatchewan progressive voice out there. And this looked like a great opportunity for me to be able to go in the form of a citizen journalist to witness the citizen mobilization that was happening. So on Friday, we went to the Council of Canadians Shout Out for Global Justice that they held. I was there with three or four friends of mine.
Okay.
We all went out there together because Toronto's too big and scary for me to go out all by myself, right? So we attended that, I guess you'd call it a lecture, where we saw eight wonderful speakers really lay out all the reasons why we are there, standing together against the forces of global economic policy.
I think that's a very important key factor in this show today.
Right.
And in the whole thing that occurred is that I don't know how many people in the general public understand why we were there, what was really going on. If you want to kind of give us a rundown of those key factors.
Right. Well, first of all, we're not part of an anti-globalization movement. On the contrary, all these issues are global. So you always hear in the media they're talking about these anti-globalists and this and that. Well, it's not true. We're actually stronger because we have global communication and we can gather everyone together to fight against the policies that our government is imposing on us and helping to impose on people around the world. A common theme throughout all the run-up to the G20 was how these policies put the financial security of the banks and the politicians on the backs of the poor and the misfortunate around the world. We're pretty lucky here in Canada. We haven't had too much to worry about as far as quality of living. But we recognize that there's a price to be paid for that. And the offset costs, like environmental destruction and poverty, those aren't being taken into account in the public sphere.
And indigenous rights as well.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a huge one, right.
Because they seem to be the first ones to lose their land and their way of living in order to increase our own quote-unquote prosperity.
Absolutely.
Now, one of the speakers that was at the shout-out for global justice was Clayton Thomas Miller. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but he's a big indigenous rights activist and one of the leads in the anti-tar sands movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was really inspiring seeing someone like that speak directly to us and to have thousands of us at Massey Hall cheering and getting fired up about all these issues.
Right. Okay. So that was on Friday?
Yeah.
That was on Friday. All right. Yeah. Let's move this to Saturday.
Okay.
Okay. We're out there. Queen's Park. Let's take the picture to Queen's Park.
Okay.
Right? How many people were in Queen's Park? How many organizations were in Queen's Park? What time did the rally start? I can't remember. Do you remember, Jim?
I think it was around 1 or so.
Around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So we have a picture here that I want to paint for the listeners. Queen's Park is packed, jam-packed, with people from many different organizations that are advocating for human rights of all different sorts, that are wanting the government to understand that they're very concerned about what's happening here in Canada and abroad and in developing nations and how human rights violations are taking place every day.
And the streets were lined with buses. There were a lot of out-of-towners there. You weren't unique. We weren't unique. You know, there were a lot of people from all over the country.
That's right. So it was a gathering of people who really, quote-unquote, something I wrote a long time ago, is who really did give a damn about what's really going on. And we all had our signs. We all had our specific clothing that would designate us as being with different organizations. Everyone was meeting together. There were speakers at the park. There were musicians. There was music going on. In general, a good feeling to be there, to feel like maybe we're going to make a difference here. Maybe someone will speak to us. I did see the mainstream media there. I did see cameras. I saw reporters talking to people. And then as we all gathered and the march started, we went on a 2.5-mile march through downtown Toronto in the rain. And somebody said to me in the midst of this, "Oh, like, this is terrible that we have to march in the rain." And they said, "Well, if you consider the daily lives of some of the people who were marching for, I think really it's not that big a deal that we're marching in the rain. When you consider that some women in African countries have to walk 2 miles every day just to get water for that day, and they can't go to school because they have to get water for the family, this is not really a big deal, right?"
Yeah, or the others who wouldn't have made it this far before the police already would have moved in and stopped.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, when you think of some of the other countries who don't allow protests as such. One of the things I wanted to bring up was Mary. And Jim, do you remember Mary's last name?
Mary Pine.
Mary Pine, yeah. Mary is an Amnesty International volunteer out of Saskatoon. She's an amazing woman. A little bit about, and I hope you don't mind, Mary, that I'm going to tell a little bit about your history. Jim really connected with her because
she's a pilot,
and Mary was a pilot back in the day, and she was a nurse. So she was a flying nurse, and Mary is in her prime years, well over 80 years old, and Mary walked with us through this pouring rain for 2.5 miles and
hours.
Chanted.
No, miles,
she,
you're right.
She was a paragon of strength and power in the middle of this march. The next day I said to her, "Mary, how are you doing? My legs are killing me." She said, "Oh, I'm fine. I could do that all over again."
I wonder,
took all kinds of people.
How would she have fared? Like if we had stayed at Queen's Park, we didn't. how would she have fared with the police coming in the way they did? Would they rough her up the way everybody else seemed to be roughed up?
What's your opinion, you guys?
Oh, okay.
This, let's just put this back into perspective, though, before you answer that question, is after the march, right. Most people went back to the park. It right. ended back at the park. Mm-hmm. The Amnesty AGM was across the street at the university. And we, you know, our marshals just said, you know, we're not going to bother going back to the park. Most of you can just come back and dry off. We'll go back to the meeting. And it was after that, very shortly after that, that all hell broke loose. And I'll let you continue with that, what happened there.
Sure. I just have to step back one day, though, to Friday,
sure. okay,
just for a second,
ahead.
Because it was on Friday that we learned about something called the Public Works Protection Act.
Oh, right, yes.
Right. Under that act, if you were anywhere 5 meters within the fence, the police could ask you for identification and search your belongings. Now, we found out, this is the Globe and Mail, Tuesday, January 29th, that's writing this. The expiration of the 5 meter rule that had Toronto residents fearing arrest if they strayed too close to the security perimeter came with a startling revelation. It never existed. Asked Tuesday if there was a 5 meter rule given the ministry's clarification, Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair smiled and said no, but he was trying to keep the criminals out. In fact, what I witnessed was that rule being applied not within, they say it only affected one person, but that's not true. Countless times I witnessed people being asked for their ID and their belongings searched in violation of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The police took that particular ruling and ran with it and misused it all over the place. And in fact, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association in the same Globe and Mail article stated the lack of transparency surrounding the designation of the security perimeter as a public work led to a misunderstanding as to the scope of the search and seizure powers during the summit, said the association spokeswoman. In our view, it was an inappropriate use of search and seizure powers. There were complaints about police engaging in arbitrary searches throughout the weekend in different areas of Toronto, far away from the G20 security zone. So this law that never existed, that was in fact only then, as it didn't exist, to apply to 5 meters within the security fence, was in fact applied throughout the city of Toronto by the police in an unlawful manner. So that's what led up to what we saw in the park, in Queen's Park. I'll need a little bit more time to talk about what was going on there because I was right in the middle of what was taking place
right.
there.
And we'll let you do that after the break. We'll take a break in a minute or two, but I'll just finish up by saying that Jim ran into someone because we weren't involved in the violent episodes after the first protest march ended. Jim had left the university and gone a number of blocks away to pick up our vehicle. And he ran into a young girl. This was his first inkling and our first inkling that something was going wrong was a young girl saw his name tag, the Amnesty name tag, and started talking to him and telling him what had happened at the park. And she said, you know, we had gone back to the park and everyone was sitting around and we were singing songs and, you know, we were talking and all of a sudden that was it. The police came in on their horses. And they started bashing people with batons, and they started just pushing everybody out of the park. She said there was people. She tell you there was a guy sleeping on the ground, and the police went after him, and he was sound asleep. So that was our first inkling. Something has gone terribly wrong here. Obviously, the police didn't think it was terribly wrong, but was for us, we were totally stunned by this. So we'll take a break, and we're going to play a song that I think a lot of you will appreciate. And we'll be back after the break to continue this conversation.
Okay, yep, we'll be right back.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. seem wrong. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Are we done? Why are you
just
starting
about
at all? It's not done yet.
It's all over.
Okay.
We played our music. Yeah. Carry on, Mona.
Okay, are we back?
Yes, we are.
Oh, I was a little disappointed. I want to hear the rest of that song.
I know. You're having a good time there.
No, it takes me back, you know.
I know.
It takes me right back. Before we go on, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of the G20. In terms of media, in terms of personal experience, we're talking the drama here, because when Jim and I were involved in it, and I think Mike mentioned, you know, that his involvement was sort of periphery to all this drama and violence, it was what we were doing, we felt, was so incredibly important, but there was just no media coverage of it, although there was until the drama hit, but nobody out there saw it. So, you know, I wanted to read a couple of things here. Garson, you mentioned the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms that have been violated. You know, Amnesty International bases our work on, for a large part, on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and I've got a few articles here. They're just so glaring. First of all, no one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, which was happening constantly, people having their bags searched, you know, having their clothing taken away from them. That's part of Article 12. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks. So how do you get protected from the law, when they're interfering and attacking you? There's my little question. Everyone charged with a penal offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proved guilty, according to law, in a public trial at which he has had all the guarantees necessary for his defense. Well, we'll get into that a little bit more, because Garson was arrested. Let's see, what else have we got here? Everyone has the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. My goodness.
Yeah, on the 13th of July, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association has filed 5 complaints against the G20 police, to the Office of the Independent Police Review Director. Their 5 complaints are the illegal mass arrest of 1,105 persons, illegal detentions, unlawful dispersal of peaceful protests, unlawful use of excessive force on peaceful protesters and passerbys, and unlawful and inadequate conditions of detention. So those are the 5 complaints that were filed July 13th by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association against the security forces with the Independent Police Review Director for the police service in Toronto. I could talk a bit about the unlawful dispersal of peaceful protests, because that's where we left off just before the song.
Sure, that's kind of where we left off.
That's what happened in Queen's Park. What we saw in Queen's Park was, as the march ended, both the the nonviolent marchers and the Black Bloc, they all came back to the Queen's Park area. Now the police are using the explanation that the crowd there was also interspersed in there with the Black Bloc participants. But as someone who's somewhat familiar with the Bloc and who was right there at the front of the arrests that were taking place right in front of the police line, I didn't see that because there's two things that were missing. One was a Black Bloc tactic that's called unarrest, where you will unarrest people if the police are grabbing them and holding them. I didn't see one protester being unarrested or even calling for it in Queen's Park. The second thing was the tactic against what was taking place, and I can talk about it very quickly, is to everyone to link arms. And again, I didn't see anyone in Queen's Park doing that. I think the people in Queen's Park were the people who were there, who were from the different affinity groups, who were there to march.
What happened
was the police decided they wanted to clear the park. They wanted the people out of there. They used a police procedure, crowd control procedure called snatch and grab. What will happen in a snatch and grab is an observer will point out people, and you can hear it on their radios, person red shirt. Well, I'm looking around too, trying to find someone with a red shirt to say they're pointing out.
So
get out
this,
of here.
You were this close to an officer that you could hear this conversation.
Oh, yeah. I was getting hit in the head.
You were getting hit in the head?
Sure. I mean, I was right there.
What were they using to hit people with?
Batons.
Batons.
Yeah. I mean, I was there as a G20 alternate media. I had press
alternate media, right?
Right.
Yeah, as a photojournalist,
yes,
I think,
right.
Wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah. So I was there with the other photojournalists. Some of them were wiser than me and had hockey helmets, but I didn't have my helmet. But what will happen is they'll point out people on different sides of their line. They want to move the right section up, then they want to move the left. So what they'll do is they'll run into a crowd. They'll identify someone. Usually someone they think is, you know, younger, youthful. Maybe they're loud in yelling at the police. They'll run in, 5, 6 police, grab them. Other police are behind them watching their back and pulling them back out, and they'll arrest that person. What will happen is that the crowd will all run in sort of directions, and they move up 10, 15 meters. Once they've sort of advanced one of their lines far enough, they'll start moving on the left and start identifying people in the crowd. The police up front will be told, grab, snatch so-and-so, person red shirt. They will run after, grab that person, arrest them, and that moves the line up. So we did that for hours. I mean, I'll give it to the protesters. They stayed for hours. It took them maybe 4 hours to push us back to a street in Toronto when the police then finally gave up. At one point near the end, some of the police yelled out, oh, come on, give it up for today. We'll do this again tomorrow.
They were tired.
They were worn out.
They were exhausted.
They were urinating in the bushes. I mean, they'd had it. I mean, they got heavy equipment on.
Yep.
And you know, most
and
of the demonstrators.
It was damp.
It was humid
because after the rain stopped, it got hot. Yeah.
And you know, they're doing this snatch and grab where they got to keep running ahead, trying to gain 10, 15 meters to push people back and keep doing this. And they had to do it for hours. Now, a lot of the demonstrators didn't have a clue what was going on. They thought it was a designated protest.
Exactly.
So why are they being treated like this?
Exactly.
I heard that time and again, people screaming, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Well, the reason was they wanted to clear the area. They used breach of the peace as the reason that they can arrest these people. So that's what the Canadian Civil Liberties Association is going after them for. They've misused the law called breach of peace. The most common charge I heard being yelled to people was either breach of peace or conspiracy to commit mischief. Those were the two most common charges I would hear being screamed out by the police at people. Both misused. In fact, that's what the Canadian Civil Liberties Association had said in their complaint, that, again, I can just briefly, Canadian law imposes limits on preventative arrests, which are not respected during the G20. The breach of peace provision must not be used to unlawfully detain and indiscriminately arrest large groups of people. We understand the enormous responsibility upon police to protect the peace, but police cannot use the breach of peace provisions to act in a manner that is unlawful. All arrests, detentions, and use of force must comply with the Charter of Criminal Laws. The courts are clear breach of peace is only grounds for arrest if there is an imminent threat of danger to persons or property by a specific individual being arrested. Mass arrests are illegal.
So that's what was taking
place. The police decided they were going to empty the Queen's Park.
Right.
This is on Saturday. The way they were going to do it was what's called snatch and grab. that's a way of moving people back. The reason I know these aren't block people is because block people will not allow themselves to be peacefully arrested and do a thing called unarrest. The way to act against snatch and grab by the police is to everyone lock arms. That's the common
tactic. I've seen that as well in the past.
Sure, makes it very hard for the police to conduct that if everyone is in the lines or all locking arms. Again, these people did not have any idea what one was going on and two, how to act in a situation like that. I don't see any evidence to support their claims. And even if they did, they have to arrest the right person. The Canadian law states that the behavior of the police was unlawful. To pick out someone in the crowd, say, okay, go for the guy in the red shirt, snatch, grab, is illegal.
But I don't think it's going to be hard to figure out what they're going to use as their argument for these tactics. There was there was proof. There was a group of black bloc who, yes, they got violent, and yes, they were vandalizing property. So therefore, they have to just assume everybody who is standing around in Toronto in the rain is an imminent threat, right?
Yeah, the rain's another day. That's Sunday. That was even the worst event of the police.
But Sunday got worse, didn't it?
Well, no, Sunday was a more egregious violation of the law.
Right.
But we had rain on Saturday.
Yes.
Rain was on Saturday.
Yeah, I was just talking about in Queen's Park.
Yeah.
I mean, they used the black block and their reaction to that as an excuse to just, well, we got to keep it going. We have to make sure that, that everybody is taken out of the streets because, as far as we're concerned, everyone's a threat.
Right.
And I think that the police were so confused as well by what laws they were actually operating under and what the rules were. Nobody knew if there was that 5 meters outside the fence or not, or is this somewhere where you're allowed to gather as you wish, or are we going to use the charge of unlawful assembly, which I think is rather startling that it's in the Canadian Criminal Code, you know, the same book that has our rights and freedoms laid out in there. We actually have a law for unlawful assembly. I didn't know that could exist here.
Sometimes I get speechless. Sorry. okay, where do we take this? There's so many places we can take this. How much time have we got? We got about 15 minutes left here. Okay, what can we make the most impact with in 15 minutes? Maybe I'll just continue for a minute or so with our perspective from Gemini. When we went back to our space at Victoria University and we dried off and we changed our clothes, a number of us left the building and went a couple of blocks away from the park in the opposite direction, not being aware of what was going on, went into a little bar. There was probably about a dozen of us sitting around the table having a beer, watching FIFA, watching, was it Ghana beat? Jim, you remember, what was it?
Ghana and the States.
Ghana and the States. And
Ghana won.
So on one TV, you know, people are cheering
because
Ghana won. And I looked over at another TV and I see this burning police car.
Yeah, all of a sudden.
And I said, oh, my God, look what's happening here.
Like, I guess our big question here is, with all this police force, how is that possible? Like, how did the Black Bloc get to two police cars and smash them up and set them on fire? And
because, like, I took pictures of thousands of police officers in this city.
How did that happen? That doesn't make any sense.
And is it possible that they actually did get to the police cars, or was it some kind of a conspiracy? And you have written about that, Carson.
Yes, I wrote an article, Disrupt the Movement, State Security, and the Black Bloc, where I talk about these sort of conspiracy theories about it. And again, I don't see evidence for it. I think, and as I wrote, the events are pretty well as they appeared. When the block was kept at two different streets, we moved back up against the official parade route. The police, for whatever reason, hadn't shut down the parade route at that point. That's when the first police cars were damaged. Then we moved down through the financial district, but only so far. I think the police down there were caught unawares. Now, we'll see many photos of the police standing there watching their vehicles being destroyed and property, but there's a reason for that. Those police are stationed there to protect routes to the fence. they're not there to be chasing people. If they leave those positions, they've left
then
the route open.
Then they're leaving their post.
They've left, that's right, because the police have adopted tactics from the militaries. In the civil rights movement, there used to be two police running around chasing everyone. They learned it didn't work. The military are experienced at crowd control. They adopted their tactics, but also their command structure. Their command structure is very rigid. Therefore, when the police are there at these streets, if they were to run after the protesters, they've left that street wide open for the protests to move down towards the G20 summit. Therefore, they're going to stand there and watch. As I saw them and as I photographed, they're putting on their tear gases masks, expecting maybe an assault on their positions. So the block kept moving on the only routes that were open. And I also have photographs of the police running from the block in my article.
Running from the block?
Yes, I have
police
a number.
Running from
yes,
the
I have a number of photos of that.
What were the weapons that the block had?
The usual sticks, stuff on the streets, water
rocks,
bottles, bricks, you know, chopped.
Those were their, and the police were running from them.
You know, their police radios are falling out. They're jumping.
Oh, Garson's showing us pictures here.
Yeah, they're in my article. They're hanging on to a Toronto transit vehicle, I believe six of them, trying to stay ahead of the block, and I'm up there, again, because my purpose was to focus on the police behavior. The police are running because they have put their forces on around the idea of people going for the fence. Therefore, the amount of police they've allotted to sort of crowd control is very small. The police are caught on guard, and they're running. So I myself, from what I observed, and other people have written as well, I mean, what we saw is basically what happened. We saw the police blocking paths to the fence. They considered that the main objective for the protesters. They did not have an amount of force on crowd control for the march. And so they weren't going to abandon their positions and open up routes to the G20 summit's location for us. So they stood at their locations, and the block moved through the financial district is basically what happened. And the police that were on the ground were what I call light on the ground, meaning very few people on that duty, and you can see them running.
But what we couldn't understand is why was that police car left unattended in the middle of that intersection? When we left the protest march, we walked through Chinatown.
But we also saw the
World Cup soccer game on TV, and we're sitting there, and there's a couple of tables of people that weren't participating in any of the marches or anything. They had shown up to watch the game. And when the game was done, then the news reports were all over the TV. And here's a reporter standing beside this burning police cruiser. And at the other table, they went, well, where are the police? Because we saw, and I saw personally on the march, every time you saw a police cruiser, there were dozens of police officers surrounding it, making a wall with their bicycles and a wall with their big shields. And as soon as the Black Bloc, when they went east from Spadina and Queen to where they eventually, you know, forced the issue on the police, as soon as they left, dozens at a time of these fully armored, gas masked stormtroopers came in to where those cruisers were on Queen Street, and then they just spread out until they had divided and blocked the street. So we had to start using alleys to even get around. It was like it was obvious they were expecting you to come back, and this is where they were going to stop you. And I think that's where the second car, the car I'm talking about, actually burned. Because on TV, I saw the same record store as we were standing beside.
I was there while those cars were occupied and when the police got out of them and when they started on fire. And I have those photos again in my article. Again, those are police that are patrolling the streets. They were not ready for the actions of the block. You see, the block, again, as a tactic, is very fluid. The decisions are made on the spot. The police have a lot of trouble reacting to something like that. So it's not like, okay, we have a plan. But it's not like there's a plan we're going down this street. It's the street block. Let's move. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of debating and yelling and pushing and shoving within the block about where to go, how to move. It's a very fluid type of decision making by consensus on the spot. Well, the police have a very hard time dealing with that because their command structure is more rigid and more designed along the military. So when those police cars are down there, there's sticks, there's water bottles, there's balloons with paint in them being thrown, they're frightened. I mean, I have a picture in my article. The police are very frightened. They're unexpecting this. They're with the other officers, and the cars are there, and the cars then got damaged. Those police kept moving to stay away from this block that's moving. Again, because there's so few of them, and most of the police assets are devoted to protecting this G20 area. So the reason they'll move in later is because their response is much slower because of the way they're structured than the block, which is a very fluid way of moving. The police have a harder time reacting to it and moving their police forces there. So then you'll see them all standing around this burning car for some reason I can't explain. But that's their response is very slow because the disruptive movement is basically a mob. Historically, mobs are very hard to control because they're unpredictable in where they're going to go. So we see that action in Toronto.
And then we move to, if a mob is hard to control, okay, well, let's pick out individuals. Instead of dealing with the mob, let's go for maybe the periphery. And that's when, in my opinion, all hell broke loose apart from the park. But further on, when anybody could have been arrested for any particular reason and asked to produce identification, it was demanded of them to show what was in their purses or their bags or their backpacks.
Yes.
And this is where the violations were occurring, those human rights violations, to a huge degree. And if anybody is interested who really has not paid much attention to this, but they're interested in finding out, you know, firsthand accounts, go on YouTube. Go into YouTube, just Google YouTube, and type in G20. There's hundreds of videos, people's first-hand experiences. People were videotaping, they were taking pictures while all this was going on. You can get more knowledge from those videos than you can from this show any day. We're only four people who had our experiences.
You know, one thing occurs to me, it's a bit of a concern. I think the police found their tactics to be unsuccessful.
Yes.
They couldn't call this a success at all.
No.
I'm wondering if, given today's political climate, whether you might find in subsequent protest situations that they adapt more aggressive, more destructive control techniques, and more people can get hurt, just by virtue of the more aggressive behavior.
Right. I mean, I think there's been a tactical mistake on the part of the left. Instead of denouncing what took place, what has happened historically, let's say Gandhi's movement or Martin Luther King's movement, was they would say, well, you better deal with us. So you better deal with Amnesty International, you better deal with Council of Canadians, because if you don't, look, it's going to happen.
Mm.
Right? I mean, that's how they used to act. They wouldn't go out and sort of denounce these things. They'd say, well, if you don't deal with us, you're going to have to deal with them. So I think on the left, they're making very, wrong strategic decisions. They should use this to their advantage. They should say, you can deal with us, or you can deal with riots in the streets, and use it to gain some of the concessions that these groups want. How are the police going to react? Well, there's a limit to the force that they can use, of course. I mean, they can't treat us like they treat people in Afghanistan. They can't treat us like they treat people in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot use those kind of amount of force against your own population. There's a limit, and that's one of the things that I wrote about in my article, that it does demonstrate, the block demonstrates the sort of limits to this idea that the police are all-powerful and that the rules have to be followed. We can see that, in fact, for 2-3 hours the rules can be broken and the police rather powerless to stop it. It sort of gets at the myth that it's powerless, I can't do anything. So it serves as a powerful symbol in people's minds. So that's why I say the left is really missing an opportunity to say, you deal with us or you're going to have to deal with it in the streets.
Right. I think one of the important things that I would like to bring up is the human rights violations that occurred during these arrests are abominable, absolutely abominable. The personal stories that have come out of this, and they've come out over and over again. It's not just one person saying this has happened to me. It's numerous people saying this has happened to me, and all the stories connect. One of the things that you wrote about Garson was concept of someone accusing you of being gay, and as if this was something that was an issue. But I think it's important to note, because there are many stories coming out about people who were overtly appearing to be gay or lesbian being cordoned off, sectioned off, put into cells together, being verbally abused. So you know, that's one issue in itself. It's not illegal to be gay in Canada, number one. And then there was number two, women being strip searched by males, women being sexually assaulted during their strip search by, I'm not sure, males or females, but sexual assault is sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking young women here. They mm-hmm. targeted young people.
Yes.
There were people there who, a lot of people there who were not young, who were middle-aged or over, but they targeted the young people. That's a big concern for me.
Well, they know who they should be frightened of. Because anybody over 50, they don't have to worry. Life has been good for them. They're just waiting for the clock to run out, right? I mean,
thank you, Mike.
I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the perception of our government when they're responding to this. And I think this is a great chance for us to say, well, start reevaluating what it is you're trying to even secure. Was this really about the safety of the leaders of the G20? I don't think there was anyone there who wanted to get anywhere even close to the convention center.
Except Garson.
Well, maybe except Garson. Okay. But as far as the rest of us, I mean, why spend $1 billion to secure against a peaceful protest?
A bunch of kids.
Yeah, and what you said, there were just over 1,000 people that were caught and detained. Well, I think as Canadians, we could be pretty proud of that, because that means it costs roughly $1 million to suppress one of us, no matter what we're trying to do.
That's interesting, Matt.
$1 million a person. Yeah.
Well,
no, you're right, Mona, because one of the things that the Chief of Police, William Blair, actually is very proud about is his relationship with the gay community.
Oh, yes, yeah. And that's another
that's
whole
right.
show.
Because
of what happened after.
For his for his officers to act like that is, I think, a very sensitive topic. And I think that the gay community has a lot of strategic power right now, because he does pride himself on having this good relationship. He talks about it. He seems genuinely impressed with his relationship. For that to be shattered the way it has, I think it's very damaging to him.
It is. I think this whole thing has been incredibly damaging to Canada in general. We have about 30 seconds left. We're going to end the show with them. We really need to do another show on this. Thank you both for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thank you.
What can I say? Tomorrow's a rally. Be downtown, Scar Street Mall at the Buffalo at 11 a.m. There is going to be a huge rally because as Amnesty's position on this is they want a public inquiry, an independent inquiry on what the police did, on their tactics. We're going to be protesting this tomorrow. And Garson is going to be speaking. I'm going to be speaking.
These are nationwide.
Oh, good. Yes. Go
That's
ahead.
What I wanted to mention. These are nationwide. Yes. They're happening in cities across Canada, not just Regina.
That's right.
And Toronto last week had 1,200 people out on their march. So I just want to mention that civil liberties are our right, not our privilege. These are being held across Canada.
Okay.
Tomorrow.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio and CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said it's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness.